This edition of The Recap was first broadcast on the 6th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards and welcome to The Recap, bringing you the highlights from the past week's live news and analysis programmes, broadcast right here on Monocle 24. Over the next half hour, we'll bring you some of the very best interviews and reports from The Globalist, The Briefing, Midori House, The Monocle Daily and The Ten. Coming up, tensions between Russia and the West leave France with two warships that no one seems to want. Then we'll hear why the former Georgian president Mikhail Saakashvili has moved to Ukraine and given up his old citizenship. We'll also discuss what Malaysia Airlines should do to rescue itself and why showbiz may be returning to Hollywood. All that and much, much more coming up in the next half hour right here on The Recap with me, Tom Edwards. We start with Malaysia Airlines, a company in deep financial trouble. The airline has outlined plans for a major restructure that will see the carrier cut around 6,000 jobs as it struggles to stay in business. The newly appointed chief executive of the loss-making carrier, Christoph Müller, says the company is technically bankrupt. The airline's due to begin operations under a new brand on the 1st of September. It's expected the company will scrap some international routes and review its long-haul fleet. On Monday's edition of The Briefing, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck discussed the options Malaysia Airlines has left with our editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé.
In the history of aviation, no one has had the very bad luck that certainly Malaysia had last year, losing two 777s. That was bad enough. But already, even before that happened, Andrew, the airline was in very difficult shape. It's been struggling to define Kuala Lumpur as being a proper hub. And many have argued that, you know, perhaps there's just not enough space because down the street you've got, or up the street you could say, you have Thai, and Thai's also been in a bit of trouble as well. But of course, you know, Bangkok is a major hub. Down the street, of course, you've got Singapore. And then with, you know, amidst all of that, then you've of course seen probably over the last 5 years, the rise of the Gulf carriers, which have made Malaysia something of a flyover state. You don't have to stop in Malaysia anymore to connect. And that's been one of their bigger problems. They've been on the back foot and they haven't had much of a brand. So I would say Mr. Müller has a very busy few months ahead of him, but it's pretty clear what needs to be done.
And those things to be done, do you feel that they're going to become a more regional airline? That we said the long-haul routes, especially with the Gulf players who, you know, cut costs to a minimum, does that seem how he has to kind of push the company forward?
I mean, if you recall before the rise of Qatar Airways, before the rise of Etihad, the Gulf was really dominated by Emirates and then this other carrier called Gulf Air, and Gulf Air was based out of Bahrain and is still there, but they also went through a very painful process where they decided they just weren't going to be in the game anymore. So yes, they still have to connect Bahrain, but there's very few flights and they're not much of a long-haul carrier. They go into a couple of main routes. They go into London and a couple of other European cities, but they're not a big player and they've really just focused on the Middle East. I think you'll see Malaysian do the exact same thing. Will they keep flying the A380 into London? Maybe. Will they even keep the A380? Question mark over that. But yes, they'll probably do, you know, one or two routes. But you won't see the glamour days when they used to have flights that went, they used to have one very interesting flight, which went from KL to South Africa and then connected on to Latin America, which was one of the longest single flights in the world. They're going to move out of that territory. I mean, we hate to sort of fall back on, yes, you know, does this company need to behave like a startup? It needs to behave like a new airline. I'm not saying that it needs to take the values of a West Coast upstart. Absolutely not. But it has to be a completely new day. It needs to be fit and nimble. And largely, it needs to, I think, establish its territory within Asia first.
That was Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brulé with our editor Andrew Tuck on Monday's edition of The Briefing. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Earlier this week, former Georgian president Mikhail Saakashvili announced that he was giving up his Georgian citizenship as he becomes the governor of the Odessa region in Ukraine. A week ago, Ukraine's president Petro Poroshenko made a surprise announcement about Saakashvili's new job, describing him as a great friend of Ukraine and granting him citizenship. Monocle Steve Bloomfield was looking for answers for this rather surprising news story on Tuesday's edition of The Briefing. He spoke to Steve Novetsky from the Ukrainian Institute based here in London.
It seems a little strange, a former president giving up his citizenship and taking up that of a neighbouring country. What do you think the thinking is behind it?
Obviously, it's related to the political landscape in Georgia, where there are now at an official level serious attempts to try and extradite him and have him stand trial for all sorts of issues to do with him exceeding his powers, allegedly, whilst president of Georgia, the third president of Georgia. I think the point about him changing his citizenship is a purely pragmatic one and has nothing to do with disassociating himself from Georgia. And it's simply that he's the best man for the job at this point in time.
Do you know what connection he has with Odessa? Is there sort of a strong link between Georgia and Odessa that actually makes it quite realistic that someone will feel at home in both?
Well, I think there is in terms of the ports and the connections between them on a purely sort of logistical level. But I think Saakashvili is more in terms of an achiever and having a legacy in Georgia where he's outrooted or got rid of much of the corruption that existed there previously and has shown that he can actually implement policies as opposed to, you know, just postulating about them, which is something that's required in Odessa. Not so much that there's a heavy Georgian ethnic minority there, it's that that particular city, a population of 1 million, is significant strategically. It's Ukraine's largest port in terms of trade. It's now the home base of the Black Sea Fleet, the Ukrainian Navy. So on a strategic level, it's very important, which why it needs somebody there who has the capability and capacity to actually grapple with the issues that are confronting that city and that region indeed.
And how do you expect him to be welcomed by the citizens of Odessa? Are there not surely going to be people there who say, well, hang on, there's 1 million of us who are from here. Surely if a governor is to be appointed, it should be someone who is actually from Odessa, not from another country altogether.
Well, just to clarify, the Odessa region, which is about 2.5 million in population. But you're right, in terms of the principle, it seems odd. But this is the revolutionary situation that Ukraine's in. Two of its ministers, at least, one Lithuanian, the other American citizen, Yuresko. It's something which is common practice now in Ukraine in terms of having the best people to do the job. But the point about Odessa is it does have its own representative government, which is democratically elected, and the people express their will through those deputies and through those senior representatives at a political level. This is the presidential arm. So he's actually heading up the regional government, which is representative of the president of Ukraine. So they're responsible for things like adhering to the constitution, making sure that if any national programs at a regional level are implemented correctly, as well as all the other trappings of, you know, making sure that the economy flourishes and that things continue in as peaceful a manner as possible. So democratically, there's no deficit because the people of the Odessa region have their organs of government and their representatives democratically elected. This is more the executive arm.
That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of The Briefing. Steve Novetsky from the Ukrainian Institute in London speaking to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield about why former Georgian President Mikhail Saakashvili has moved to Ukraine. You're with The Recap on Monocle 24. Let's continue the programme with a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House next. 1 week ago, Nigeria's new president, Muhammadu Buhari, made a statement of intent about the struggles against Boko Haram, the Islamist insurgency responsible for at least 13,000 deaths in the last 6 years. He said he'd move the military command centre of the war from Nigeria's capital to Maiduguri, Boko Haram's birthplace. That's what Andrew Muller discussed with Isabel Hilton, editor of China Dialogue, and James Schneider, editorial director at New African magazine. They started by talking about James's recent visit to Cameroon.
From the Cameroonian side, it's progressing reasonably well. They look like they've got pretty well-trained, well-armed and fairly effective special forces who are running around and dealing with the problem there. But the main problem is, of course, in Nigeria. And actually, Nigeria and Cameroon aren't really cooperating at all. In fact, they're not cooperating at all on this issue.
Why aren't they cooperating? They would appear to have at least a common enemy.
Yes, but they have a history of distrust. They've fought over the Bekasi Peninsula in the southeast of Nigeria, sort of west of Cameroon. And they don't like each other. No one will really go on the record, and although I was trying to press people to say precisely what it is that is the red line that will not allow them to have any engagement with one another. But Cameroonian forces can't cross over to the Nigerian border or vice versa, even if in hot pursuit of Boko Haram. There's zero intelligence sharing. And tomorrow, Buhari is going to Chad and to Niger to talk about how they're fighting Boko Haram. He's not going to go to Cameroon.
Isabel, as a general principle, and this has now been a dominating theme of current affairs for the last few years now, reaching all the way from West Africa to the Middle East, of tackling non-state Islamist insurgencies, which appear as really not to have even the beginnings of any sort of actually negotiable, coherent political agenda. In fact, give often just every impression of just being motivated by utter nihilism. Are we actually learning anything about dealing with them at all?
Well, I think we've learned that you can't fight them from afar, that if local forces are not both committed and competent, then you make no progress. But also, as James said, that what alienates people, what drives them either to tolerate or support these insurgencies, can be something quite other than an attachment to Islamism. And I think we see that in many of these countries, that, you know, you have, in Iraq, for instance, you have tribes that are alienated from the government, which tolerate, therefore, if not support, an Islamic insurgency. But that doesn't mean that the situation can't be recovered. It just means that I think that our characterization of these insurgencies is too crude. It doesn't differentiate one from the other. And we've taken the wrong approach to date. But I think that people are learning.
We have to recognize that these insurgencies, they change over time, and the way in which one can deal with them changes over time. So if you look at Boko Haram in, let's say, 10 years ago, but they could have been dealt with somewhat, as in some kind of negotiations in terms of the amount of Sharia law that would take place in some states of Nigeria, with some aspects of funding for religious schools and so on and so forth. There's something you could do there. Then as they become a bit more radical after the clampdown on them and the killing of their leader in 2009, you could say, well, we'll release certain prisoners. There's certain things you can negotiate with. But then as it becomes more radical, and now where the majority of the fighters are, you know, 15-year-old children who are given tramadol to go and fight and are paid $150 to attack a village, then you've left the realms of something that you can negotiate with. And it's also something that isn't purely ideological either. You've got this other thing which is feeding on itself, and it's feeding on the local community where it can, and then you have to deal with it in a different manner.
Monocle's Andrew Muller there with Isabel Hilton and James Schneider. That was a highlight from Tuesday's edition of Midori House, and you can download the whole programme from Monocle's website or from iTunes or SoundCloud. Up next, why did German Chancellor Angela Merkel agree to meet Egypt's President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and what France can do with two massive warships that no one seems to want. Stay tuned.
If you're after a soundtrack to your working day, look no further than Monocle 24's Globally Minded playlist. We play the very best upbeat music from around the world, around the clock. Whether that's jazz from Japan, pop from Paris, house from Hamburg, or soul from Seoul. It's all picked by our team and presented by our editors. So get lost in music with Monocle 24's playlist, right here, day and night, on Monocle 24.
You're listening to The Recap, a look back at our coverage of the week gone by in live news shows hosted here at Monocle 24. I'm Tom Edwards. Since toppling the ruling Muslim Brotherhood, now seen as a terrorist organisation, Egypt's president Abdel Fattah el-Sisi has overseen mass arrests, huge numbers of death sentences, and persecution of any number of opposition. There have also been many promises, all of them broken, to hold elections in the country, although no word of how fair they'd be. This was enough, though, for Germany's Angela Merkel to refuse him a visit, fending off call after call from Egyptian diplomats. However, she buckled with the promise of elections in April and agreed to host el-Sisi, who arrived in Berlin on Wednesday. So where did this change of heart come from, and how does this look for the normally strong-willed German Chancellor? On Wednesday's edition of The Globalist, Monocle's Georgina Godwin was joined by Ruth Michelson, a journalist based in Cairo, and Adel Darwish, political columnist at Tribune and political editor at Middle East News.
The pressure actually was coming from different human rights organizations. And Egypt's got an important partner. The Islamists are actually taking hold of the Middle East. And now we have seen the Islamic States making a stronghold in Libya, which is a launch pad, not only for disorder migrants losing their life coming to Europe, but also terrorists might be slipping into Europe. It's seen that the Sisi government is quite a strong stance against the Islamists. And the Muslim Brotherhood, as an organization, are actually the granddaddy of ideology and organization of this group. And finally, again, some advice I understand that what happened in Iraq in the early zeros of this century, when we largely based our assessment in Iraq on the so-called human rights organizations taking testimonies from Iraqi dissidents, and we had come up with the weapons of mass destruction, crimes of regime, which all turned out to be not 100% true. And we'll see what's happening in Iraq now. So we have this largely in Europe and here in Britain, people saying, okay, let's actually take this report with a pinch of salt and look at the real situation on the ground.
Right, right. How's he viewed in back in Egypt, Ruth, al-Sisi?
Well, Sisi's, generally, he's got a huge amount of popular support on the ground in Egypt, but that support obviously doesn't come from his human rights record. Sisi came in and promised stability, and that's where he draws his legitimacy from. And so the kind of attacks that... we've seen this pressure that's on Merkel from this coalition of human rights groups. That's, I suppose, as kind of Adel pointed out, it's sort of viewed as something of a misunderstanding of what Sisi's trying to do, or tarnishing the image of the Egyptian state in some way. But I don't think necessarily it affects how the average person here feels about this visit.
They think it's a positive thing, clearly.
The visit, absolutely. I mean, I suppose the visit really shows a kind of statecraft, right? It's nation building. It's showing that Sisi is visiting, you know, this country that's at the heart of Europe and is being influential. The thing to remember is that Sisi is signing quite a large sum of energy deals with Siemens in Germany. And, you know, that's something that is really cementing ties between the two countries. And so whatever we're seeing on the surface politically, underneath, the ties are strengthening, even if there is this pressure for Merkel to criticise Sisi's human rights.
The endorsement of Sisi isn't unanimous, though, is it? The Speaker of the House has refused to get involved. He's at Lamet. He's cancelled plans to meet him.
Yes, and obviously when you see that... A large part of the criticism, as we've heard from Cairo, is not just human rights. It is, in fact, a confusion in sorting out a constitution, the confusion in actually holding parliamentary election. And it's quite a surprise why they have been actually delaying parliamentary election. So you can understand the Speaker of the Parliament, who actually gets the legitimacy that the government must be democratically elected. I mean, Germany is not actually... like in Britain, where every single sort of almost member of the cabinet is an MP, but it is the actual basis of elected government. And I can understand why the Speaker actually is refusing to meet him until they come up with holding parliamentary election. And that's something that's really weird about the Egyptians. I don't really understand, because there was a massive support for Sisi in June, July, August 2013. And you think when the Muslim Brotherhood totally routed out, that is time when they can hold elections would actually reflect some kind of majority will. And I'm actually puzzled, although I've been covering the Middle East many years, I spent 3 years as correspondent in Cairo in the late 70s. I still don't understand what the reason why they're not holding parliamentary election.
And why they didn't do it, particularly then when the support was at its strongest.
It's what's so stronger, and people actually would have been willing to go out and think. And I probably doubt it very much if they hold election now, the turnout would be quite high. It will be below 55 or even 45%, because people are busy about their daily life.
Ruth Michelson, a journalist based in Cairo, and Adel Darwish, political columnist at Tribune and political editor at Middle East News, talking to Monocle's Georgina Godwin on Wednesday's edition of The Globalist. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24 with me, Tom Edwards. Now, what does one do with a spare warship or two? That's a question facing France after tensions between Russia and the West put the brakes on a deal in which Moscow was to purchase two French-built helicopter carriers. The intended deal stems from Nicolas Sarkozy's decision back in 2011 to make the West's first major foreign arms sales to Russia since the fall of the USSR. But events in Ukraine mean that'll just have to wait. Meanwhile, Paris is left trying to save face. This is what Monocle's Andrew Tuck discussed on Wednesday's edition of Midori House with Shashank Joshi, research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute, RUSI, and Robert Fox, defence editor at the Evening Standard newspaper here in London.
Robert, how did we get in this mess?
It's Monsieur Sarkozy showing that he could break the mold and could trade with the Russians, and that remember that George W. Bush, no less, said he looked into Putin's eyes and here was a man he could trust. He didn't use the Thatcher formula for Gorbachev, but it is very difficult. And particularly these ships, the Mistral class, which are formidable helicopter carriers, and therefore they're very good at close inshore operations. And we've had, in fact, I've spoken on Monocle about it. The Swedes are desperately worried about this kind of stuff, and it really would be red rag to a bull. But it's poor old France being caught at its game. Defence sales and entrepreneurship, actually, they think entrepreneurship is, of course, based on a French word. I mean, they've been selling Rafale aircraft all over the place, and these things have consequences, and it's very difficult. And across Western Europe, of course, defence is in great crisis. The instinct, whether it's in Berlin, London, or Paris, is to cut, 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 whereas there is now a real demand for regeneration because, I don't say threat so much as real uncertainty, is something coming so close to home, whether it's people cannot catch the tiger by its tail with Putin's Russia. They're not sure whether it's Putin, whether it's his military, or whether it's Russia and the political entity of Russia as a whole. There is the problem of the Mediterranean. There's the problem of the crisis of what we have just been talking about with IS and refugees and so on, and the collapse of whole areas of around the Horn of Africa, Yemen and so on, pouring into the Mediterranean. Is it just a humanitarian crisis? Could it have a political complexion? The Italians say yes, because there are now signs of entrism of IS agents trying to get into migrant ships and so on. This is not a time when, as in the UK, they were suggesting, the leading partner in the coalition government at the turn of the year, now in a majority, the Conservatives were saying, oh, we could contemplate up to 12% in the cut in the defence budget. The word around Whitehall now to say this is that defence is ring-fenced. And this is where France is, but France doesn't have the money to find the armed forces and the equipment that it really requires.
Well, Shashank, you know, the decision not to sell the ship to Russia was, it seemed wise and sensible at the time. And, you know, it looks like it kind of left France with a bit of a problem, because now the Russians are saying even if sanctions are lifted, they probably don't want them, thank you very much, and we just want our money back.
Plus compensation. Quite a lot.
But at the end of it, France really didn't have an option, did they?
No, they didn't. Although they really were dragged into this kicking and screaming. They really wanted to sell these ships. And the reason why is France has a very different attitude to arms sales than we do.
They did too.
They did. They don't have the same squeamishness we do in this country. They will sell to anyone. They've just sold lots of planes to, you know, Al-Sisi's Egypt. That's their reputation, to do these deals without worrying about their hands getting dirty. And that helps them. It helps them flog kit to countries who are worried about whether we'll be a goody two-shoes and sell them parts if there's a war on. No one worries about whether France will. They'll do anything. So France had a reputation at stake. This is why they were worried about this, and that's why they were so reluctant. Now, what do they do? Well, it's costing them about 5 million euros a month, so that's a reasonable amount of money. You know, the ships, plus the sailors, the training, you can't just give, even you couldn't give this to a small country because it would wash out their navy. They wouldn't be able to run it. So I think France should look at India. I think India's a country that has big naval ambitions. It's a country that's expanding its defence relationship with France. It's very interested in warships like this that are capable of projecting power quite far away. It also has one of the very few growing defence budgets in the world. I think France-India sale is something that should be looked at much more carefully.
Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck there, together with Shashank Joshi and Robert Fox, a highlight from Wednesday's edition of Midori House. That programme, like all the others, available to download from Monocle's website or iTunes. You're listening to The Recap on Monocle 24. Now, in recent years, it's often seemed that California might have to truncate Irving Berlin's hymn to its most famous export to declare merely that there's no business. However, a new scheme of tax credits has sparked something of a gold rush, if one can imagine the producers of sitcoms as prospectors. The California Film Commission has approved new tax credits for 11 series which have promised to relocate from their current locations in other states, including Veep, American Horror Story, and Secrets and Lies. It's estimated that these series will bring more than $500 million in business with them. Earlier this week on the Monocle Daily, Andrew Muller and Ted Kravitz spoke to Dominic Patton from Deadline Hollywood about how the change in the state's tax system is putting their biz back in showbiz.
There's two things. For one, 11 projects have been allotted money under the first round of the new, greatly expanded $330 million annual California film and TV tax incentives. Four projects are now moving over into California that were previously elsewhere. American Horror Story's latest installment, which is known as Hotel, they were originally shooting in California for the first two seasons. Then they went to the incredibly lucrative state of Louisiana, which has been proven a very, very, very pointed thorn in California's paw in the past several years, for 2 years. And then they said they were coming back to California. Now, they had already actually come back to California, and they were due to start production early next month. They will now receive these incentives, approximately $9 million in incentives, to film in the Golden State.
Had California become an unattractive location in and of itself, or was it just that other states were becoming more attractive for those reasons?
It was all about the money. California is still the number one place in the United States, if not the world, with the exclusion, obviously, of India and the Middle Kingdom, where feature films are made. It is also the number one place where television shows are made. But in the past, I'd say 20 years, originally starting with Canadian provinces like Ontario and British Columbia, and then moving into American states like Georgia and Louisiana, and to some degree New York, which was always a popular place to film unto itself, but it got very, very aggressive about offering subsidies, you've seen the home of Hollywood hasn't really been making a lot of movies. If you look at recent years, you look at blockbusters, you only see two or three of the biggest movies made were made in California. In 2009, under a former movie star, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger, the California Film and Television Tax Incentives Program was created. But it was created with very little when you look at the grand scale of the California budget. $100 million. Why? Because there was a lot of concern that this was seen as corporate welfare. What happened is there was no corporate welfare because there were no taxpayers to pay for welfare because the film industry basically deserted the state that had been known for its creation.
Dominic Patton there from Deadline Hollywood chatting to Andrew Muller and Ted Kravitz a little earlier this week on the Monocle Daily. Well, that's all we've got time for in this week's episode of The Recap. The show was produced by Marco Sippi and edited by Wei Dong Lin and Toby Hammond. Join us again next week to hear some of the very best of our live news programmes here on Monocle 24. And now to play us out of The Recap, as we heard a few moments ago, American Horror Story is just one of many TV heavyweights set to benefit from California's tempting new tax incentives. Fans of the show might remember this track from Season 2's Asylum. It's Jessica Lange in her role as the slightly deranged Sister Jude with the name game. But for now, from me, Tom Edwards, thanks very much for listening. Goodbye. Come on, everybody. I say now let's play a game. I bet you I can make a rhyme. Are there anybody?